Welcome to Upstart Crow, a part of Watershed Lit Radio. Join us as we explore books and culture through engaging conversations with writers, historians, and creatives, offering unique insights into the literary arts and beyond. Hosted by Ken Budd, Jennifer DeSano, and William Miller. Now, here's the show.
Hello, podcast listeners. Welcome to Upstart Crow. I'm your host, William Miller. My guest today is Shubha Sunder, author of the novel Optional Practical Training, which won the 2025 New American Voices Award, sponsored by the Institute for Immigration Research, presented at the Fall for the Book Festival. Welcome, Shubha.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Now, I think we have to begin here. This is a novel. It is not a workbook training exercise.
No.
Optional practical training. This is a program, right, where people, as in the case of the novel, finish up their undergraduate degree and stay on for optional practical training.
Yes.
And that's what your character does.
Yes, it's a particular visa status, to be more specific. So when you come to the United States as an international student, you can stay an extra year. So, you know, you can get a five-year visa. I don't know if this is still the case, as, you know, we don't know how, you know, there are many things that we don't know, yeah. But when I came to the United States, as did many, many, many international students, I had a visa for 5 years. And the idea is that you can finish your degree in 4 years. And then if you want, it's optional. You can stay on to do an internship, to get some work experience. So you're still on a student visa, but you're in optional practical training or OPT status. So it's this very liminal status. You know, the novel, even though it's an immigrant novel, features a narrator who is not even an immigrant, really. She's a visitor. And she's in this position where, you know, she can stay an extra year after college, but that's really just it. And so during this year, she has to make some plans about what's next for her.
Right. And she also, if she wants to stay on, she has to move into a different visa status,
yes,
like an H-1B.
Correct.
And so she has to prove herself to, in this case.
Yes, she has to have an employer who would be willing to sponsor her for a work visa. Yes.
Right. And, you know, I don't know how many of our listeners will have read the novel. I don't want to give everything away and assume that, you know, that.
Oh, please give away as much as you like. I'm never turned off by spoilers. I think if the thing of value in a book is a whodunit, that wouldn't really interest me. There's so much that we read for. And I think this book is very much about, you know, atmosphere and inner states of mind and identities and so on. So you don't need to worry about giving anything away.
Well, it's also, I would add to that list, I agree with you completely, but I would add to that list, it's also great to read for craft if you are wanting to write a novel. It's great to read for craft. It's also great just in terms of storytelling technique and stuff. And so I want to talk about those things before we end up as well. Let's begin with how you open the novel. As you say, she's a visitor, not an immigrant. That's an important distinction in the sense of she knows she has a year. She doesn't know what she has beyond that. She's clearly in a transition point. She's just finished her undergraduate degree. She's gotten a teaching job. The first thing she has to do is look for a home. It's a very important sort of metaphor for starting a novel, but it's also very important in your character's life in terms of like finding a base, this new base. You move from a dorm to having to find your own home. That, in a sense, situates this, for me, as a kind of coming-of-age novel or story.
Sure. I mean, it's a older character. When you say coming-of-age, I tend to think of, you know, teenagers or, you know, younger people. But she certainly is starting this new phase of life, this new phase of independence, where she's already been in a new country for, you know, 4 years, but it's, you know, but she's been very sheltered. She's been on, you know, this very small college campus, and her world has been, you know, the life of a college student. And now she's kind of stepping out and, you know, she's on her own. And she wants to be an artist. That is her heart's desire. And she has to figure out how to do that. So she's graduated with a degree in physics. And, you know, I became aware when I was writing this novel that, you know, it was going to be an immigrant novel. And I didn't really know of an immigrant story where we have a character who comes to the United States, you know, not for the traditional reasons of, you know, asylum or to build a better life, but simply to find a room of her own, to figure out how to be an artist. And so that was the question that propelled me, you know, kind of through the book. You know, what happens when we have someone in this situation who comes from relative privilege? You know, she's not in the U.S. as a matter of survival, as a matter of, you know, economic necessity. This is a choice she's made because she is someone who has access to choices. So what does that mean for someone in a position of relative privilege to come to the United States from a place like India and figure out how to be an artist? And of course, her first step, as you said, is to find a home in a place like Boston. Since she wants to be a writer, she wants to be in a literary city, and it's not inexpensive. And she, you know, doesn't have the options available to her that an American citizen would have. She can't wait tables. She can't pump gas. She has to be able to be sponsored. She has to have an employer who will sponsor her for an H-1B visa, which means she has to take on this, you know, full-time teaching job at a local high school because that's what she's applied for. And, you know, that's the job that she's got.
And I assume that the optional practical training program has some restrictions in terms of work.
Absolutely. Yes. Yeah. Yes. I mean, it's quite a lot of responsibility placed on the employer. I think they have to show that they're taking on a foreigner because it's a position that they would find hard to fill.
And the HR person at this little school where she works is a treat, is a characterization. I wouldn't want to work with her or have to interact with her, but to read her on the page is a delight. She's quite a character.
Yes, I would say she came up in my conversations with my editor after she had acquired the book, and we were talking about the spectrum of characters and, you know, how far did the book want to go into caricature. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I certainly wanted the key characters to be rounded and, you know, fully dimensional. But it was fun to play with a bit of color around the edges. So I think of her as one of those like peripheral characters who's there for comic effect and is pretty outrageous. Yeah.
Right. When she's talking to this prospective landlord, though, and this opens the first paragraph of the first chapter of the novel, this prospective landlord begins to tell her an anecdote that comes up from his discussion group about a Sikh who came to the U.S. and applied for citizenship. And I dug into that a little bit because I got to the acknowledgments afterward in the back, and I realized this is a real case, the thing he talks about in the beginning.
Yes, the case of Bhagat Singh Thind, who came to the United States in like the 30s, around the time of the First World War, and wanted to, you know, become a citizen. And at that point in U.S. history, citizenship was restricted to white people, to white immigrants. So if you came from abroad and you wanted to be a citizen, you had to essentially prove that you were white, which is what his lawyer tried to do in these, you know, very convoluted, absurd manner. Yeah.
And in fact, he came in the early part of the 20th century, but the law under which they were working was the 1790 Naturalization Act. So from like 1790, not long after we became a country, until the 20th century, that was the main way that people became citizens, was by proving that they were white. And I want to point this out because I mentioned this anecdote that's embedded very cleverly into your novel. And someone said, well, I didn't know we ever had that rule, but we did. For hundreds of years, the pathway toward naturalization was to say you were white. And of course, in there along the way, they freed the black African slaves, and that, of course, would have provided them the pathway if they were white, but one drop of black blood, that famous rule, kept them from qualifying, which was interesting unto itself. But here, this gentleman and his cases precede, and went all the way to the Supreme Court, the U.S. Supreme Court, and he had this lawyer, and your character kind of collapses the legalities a bit, which, of course, you're opening this a novel. You're not going to go into all of this. It was fascinating that the court had ruled on a previous case with a Japanese gentleman that he didn't qualify, even though he had basically erased his Japanese heritage and lived as an American and thought as an American. And even though this guy, Thind, had become a very prominent philosopher, religious scholar who gave lectures all across the U.S. to thousands of people.
Yeah, and eventually he fought in the U.S. Army as well. And then, you know, many years on, he was finally granted citizenship as a result of that.
Exactly. In 1936, he got citizenship because there was an act that went back and gave citizenship to everybody who had fought in World War One. Yeah. But the Smithsonian has a picture of him in his army uniform. And because he was Sikh.
His turban, yes.
Yeah, his turban. Fascinating, fascinating story. Why did you open with that?
Well, it was just one of those things that came to me. I mean, I had heard about Bhagat Singh Thind on a podcast. And, you know, I listened to a lot of podcasts that then often make me, you know, read the books that are mentioned in those podcasts. And so this was something I knew about, you know, for a long time. I never thought it would make it into a novel. But when I was writing the opening and, you know, I knew that this first conversation was going to be with her landlord and I wanted to make him, and it was the first conversation, so it had to be, you know, particularly interesting to grab the reader's attention. And I just thought of Bhagat Singh Thind, and I thought it would be particularly interesting to have the landlord tell her this story, which, you know, would make sense. She's not been here, you know, long enough to have come across it herself. And the landlord is someone who, you know, certainly sees himself as very cosmopolitan. He rents apartments in Cambridge, Massachusetts, which is, you know, full of international students, scholars, and he takes a certain pride in, you know, meeting people from around the world. And he himself is, you know, well-traveled. And he is interested in you know, what it means to be American. And he sees this, you know, young person and, you know, he likes her. And, you know, and he assumes, as so many of the characters in the novel, you know, make assumptions about the narrator. He kind of like just assumes that, you know, she's here and she's going to be successful in some way and she's going to stay. And so he sort of like takes it upon himself to tell her this story of, you know, what it means to be an Indian person coming here to settle.
He goes on with it, though, and talks about a member of the group, a woman who he quotes as saying that she got angry for what the lawyer and Mr. Thind did in terms of arguing.
Yes. But that was kind of like a bridge for me to talk about the notion of free will, right? Because I think that is one of the central questions of the novel. You know, how many of our choices do we really have control over? And, you know, that's a complicated question. And I wanted to introduce that idea in the beginning. And so the person in the group that the landlord talks about sort of gave me a way to get to that question of free will.
The comparison that you set up is iron filings being manipulated by magnets.
Yes. You know, the woman in the group who objected to the story of Bhagat Singh Thind said that she despised him, or really despised his lawyer, for the argument that he was making. Because essentially what he was trying to do was argue that since the argument over like literal skin color hadn't worked with the Japanese man, the lawyer tried to argue that this was a matter of caste, that since Bhagat Singh Thind was Brahmin and he came from an elevated caste in India, he should qualify for citizenship because essentially he shared that upper caste-ness with whites in America because white people in America look down on lesser races. And so this is a very perverted argument, which is why the woman in the group objected to it. But that's essentially the argument that the lawyer had to make, right? So the question is, you know, what kind of system normalizes that sort of behavior? Like, makes you have to argue that you're white to get citizenship. It's not Bhagat Singh Thind's fault. It's the institution.
But that then has your character coming into the society. And as you say, the question is choices, free will, and she will be making choices, and she will or won't be exercising free will as she makes those choices. And we watch as she goes along.
Absolutely. And there's a lot at stake for her. She is entering, you know, the teeth of this so-called progressive private school in the Boston area, which is completely, you know, which is a universe like unknown to her. It's nothing like her upbringing in India. And she is going to have to navigate it. And make choices, you know, based not only on, you know, her instincts as a person and as a teacher, but also, you know, she has to keep her job. And that entails, you know, figuring out what's expected of her.
You structure this novel around conversations, which seem to me brilliant. And you use first-person narrative technique. And that combination seemed doubly brilliant because it means that things come at her. They come at us, the reader, in the same way, but things come at her. And you also don't use dialogue in the conventional way, which means that everything kind of comes to us through her in ways that are kind of filtering, if you will, and she's taking things in. But it also means that the novel is very scenic and that the progression of the linear narrative is from scenes just axiomatically. That was, to me, the brilliant part.
Thank you. I'm glad it worked for you. It doesn't work for everyone.
It should.
Yeah, I find conversations just so interesting. You know, from a craft perspective, there's just so much you can do with, you know, well, you can tell a story, right? Like, we can tell the story of Bhagat Singh Thind. Like, once upon a time, there was a man named Bhagat Singh Thind, and he wanted to become a citizen and so on. But then imagine if that becomes someone else's story, right? It forms a layer of something that's multidimensional. This is something I just always kept leaning into when, as I was writing this novel. You know, there's something to be told, there's a story, but then if someone is telling that story to someone else, then there's all kinds of things happening at once. What do we know about the person telling the story? How are they telling it? Who are they telling it to? What assumptions are they making about that listener? And, you know, I think conversations really do, they form us, right? The things that people say to us and about us inform our sense of who we are in the world. And I think it's particularly true in the case of an immigrant, especially a young immigrant, like the narrator. The things that people say to her and about her inform her sense of who she is in America, because she hasn't grown up here. She has no other markers. And she's going to absorb the implications of the things that are both said and unsaid. And, you know, since it's a retrospective novel, it's written in the past tense, I think of it as, you know, she's telling us her origin story of how she came to the United States. And the way that she's become the person she is heavily dependent on the conversations she's had with people.
Right. It also gives her almost a kind of innocence, if you will.
Right. I mean, and she is, right? She's young. Although the novel is a bit of a digression, but it is the first of a trilogy. Yeah, I'm just done with the second, and it's called Conditional Permanent Residency. And so it's the same character, but different phase of life. I've kept the conversational mode, and it's different when Pavitra is 10 years older than she is in the first novel. There's not that same innocence. But I think, you know, so much of character, Rachel Cusk said this, is context-dependent and, you know, moment-dependent. We are who we are. You know, I think it's a very American notion of having, you know, this kind of core identity that you like take with you everywhere, whether you go to work or someone's house or whether you're in your own house. But I think who we are is very much dependent on, you know, who we're interacting with, the situation that we're in. And since this is a book ultimately about the formation of identity as an immigrant, to me, it just made sense that I, the author, should put this narrator in very, very different situations to see how she reacts and how she changes, you know, depending on where she is, who she's talking to. Yeah.
Well, and earlier I characterized it as a coming of age novel in our story. And that's why I felt that way, because she does kind of, you know, go from an innocence to a kind of more seasoned person in the course of this year of optional training.
Yes, and they are, as you said, they're kind of one-sided, and the conversations are one-sided in the sense that she doesn't often talk back. But I think that's another interesting thing about conversations, right? Or when someone is talking to you, like what they say to you sort of paints a portrait in negative of who you are, right? So in a way, I think she functions as a mirror in the sense that she reflects back to America, you know, a certain like reflection of American society, while at the same time, you know, taking in the implied messages of the things that people tell her.
She's not entirely innocent, though, because, I mean, she does have men that she has dated. And she dates a person in the course of that year. And the dumping scene where she tells him, fine, then don't go to India. Don't come to India. We don't want you. That was great.
Yeah, sort of turns the expected line of dialogue on its head, right? Like, yes. Immigrants are the ones who are being told, like, not to come to the U.S. And so for her to tell Pedro, this guy she's dating, who makes some negative comments about India, you know, then don't come. We don't want you.
Right, right.
I mean, I did want to, in every conversation, I think that people's assumptions about Pavitra are exposed, right? And I wanted her to have her own assumptions, right? Because we all have assumptions about people. We make assumptions about people that often we have no business making. And so it was important for me to have her own blind spot, her own shortcomings in that way exposed at sensitive moments.
Well, one of the questions that come up, and I don't think this gives too much away, but one of the questions that comes up, she's being a teacher, she's working as a teacher, and that is its own sphere of debate and questioning, not only for her, but for our society. You know, this is a private school where students pay to be there.
Pay a lot.
I gather. The question that comes up is, what are they paying for? What opportunity does their money buy? The privilege of education. I mean, I think that you get at it here by saying you're paying for the lecture, you're paying for the presentation, you're paying for the opportunity to learn, but you're not paying for a grade.
Yes, and some of the students and some of the parents do feel entitled to the grades that they think their children deserve. Yes, that's part of the milieu of this particular school that she teaches at. Yeah.
Well, and institutions like schools will develop a culture, a milieu. One of the funniest ones was the parent who called up and said, well, my son is a little different, you know, and I think it's like a chemistry class or something that she's complaining about the grade. And she says he should have different ways of demonstrating his knowledge. Like, couldn't he write a song?
Yes. I mean, I think the conversation with the principal, I think, exemplifies it, right? This is a business model that's sort of being imposed on this school. Right? The students are not so much students as they are clients. And the goal is client satisfaction. And so the kids need to feel like they are learning, that they are having fun, and that they're getting A's, which is a very complicated burden to put on teachers. Right? But the principal, when Pavitra has this mid-year evaluation, the principal tells her, you know, in no uncertain terms, that she recognizes that this is the challenge that Pavitra is facing. And if she is going to be successful at the school, she has to find a way of marketing herself. She has to be a brand in some way. And only she can figure that out. No one can help her with that.
You don't have her overreact to that. You don't have her go like screaming out of the room, head exploding, or anything like that.
No, if anything, she is like disturbingly open to the idea, because she's never thought of it that way. And so I think the principal's words, at least in that minute, sort of make her think, oh, okay, well, no one's put it to me that way. You know, it's not like she has an immediate solution, but something does change, I think, with her teaching, because it seems like a few months on, things are better for her in the classroom. I mean, this is inspired, as so much in the novel is inspired by my own life as a teacher. And, you know, I've certainly learned over the years how to talk differently to students than, you know, when I first was teaching. I've become a lot softer, kinder, always looking for something positive to say. And, you know, some of it I think is good and, you know, ultimately helpful to the student and, you know, makes me a more effective teacher. But it's all cultural, really. Teaching is, you know, different in different places, and certainly where I grew up, kindness and compassion and positivity would not be the things that, you know, would be a teacher's priority.
It's interesting that you have her as this, you know, young woman who's trying to make it in that kind of a situation. You know, that's part of the challenge that she faces, is making it as a teacher in a demanding situation. In that situation, she begins to see teaching as something transactional.
Well, certainly something she has to do to keep her job, right? Which is, by extension, her status in this country, so that she can keep writing. Teaching is not ultimately her passion. It is something that that she wants and needs to do well, but it's not a job that defines her the way that her writing defines her.
The artistry that we spoke of earlier, that's what she wants to do is write. We don't see that a lot, though.
Well, I mean, writing is, the work of a writer is just not very interesting to watch, right? It's hard to make scenes out of that as you could perhaps with a with an installation artist or...
Or painter or something.
Painter, yeah. Exactly, yeah. I mean, writers just sit at their desks and write or read or type. I mean, this is her account, right? So we know that she has eventually learned how to be a writer, but so much of that first year out of college is learning the ropes and figuring out how to survive. You know, just the basics. You know, how do I earn enough money to pay the rent if I want to live in a place like Boston? I have to figure out, you know, how to make time to write because teaching is such a demanding job. And she's also, you know, trying not to be lonely, trying to figure out, you know, who she is in a society where she's a complete stranger.
So the novel that we read is meant to be the work that she has produced, or is it not?
I don't think this would be a novel that she's written. For her, it's not a novel. It's the true story of her life. Yeah. But she knows how to tell it with a writer's instincts, hopefully.
Right. But it would be her telling it, not so much writing it. So what we would hold in our hand isn't the product that she might have written.
No. But she does go on to write books, for sure.
Okay. So we have that success there.
Yes.
Now, you say you're working on the next of a trilogy. Does that come into play there, her success as a writer?
Yeah, I mean, it's not like she's a blockbuster novelist. No, but she's further along the path. As she is, you know, she's further along the path in many aspects of her life. Yeah.
I guess maybe the thing that kind of draws this together for me is that stranger in a strange land kind of theme, you know? And in so many ways, she's a stranger in a strange land. I mean, the school, the U.S., the home that she's finding, which has its own perils, if you will, trying to make it as an artist, a young woman, and the landlord, I don't think it gives too much away, but he sort of smirks at her when she says she wants to be a writer.
A little bit, yeah. He finds her amusing in all kinds of ways. I mean, the idea of home was something that came up when I was revising the book after Grey Wolf had accepted it. So it's divided into parts, and I had divided it a different way when my agent submitted the novel. But as my editor and I were working on it, she suggested that it be divided the way it is now, where part one, which is also chapter one, Pavitra has no home. I mean, she is quite literally rootless because she left her college campus the previous day, spent the night on the train to Boston, and is, you know, spends the day in Cambridge, like with her luggage. She's like dragging around her suitcase from place to place, and she's going to get on a flight that evening to go back to India for the summer before she comes back to start the teaching job. And then in part two, she lives at the landlord's mother's, right, because she can't afford to actually rent one of his apartments, but he agrees to let her live at his mother's, which is quite a decrepit place, but she can afford that. And then in part three, she actually does get the apartment that she wants. And then in part four, again, she's rootless. And so I was, you know, I still am very interested in the idea of home and what it means. Some people are completely happy with the idea of two homes or multiple homes. Some people have lifelong nostalgia for some place that they left early in their lives, or even a place they've never been to, but it exists in their imaginations. Some people left a place and they want to have nothing more to do with it, and so their home is the place that they moved to. And she meets all these characters like over the course of the novel. Yeah, I think home is a very sort of, it's an idea that for people are, you know, can be very personal.
Well, in that connection, I thought that when she talked the landlord down on the rent for the apartment mm-hmm. she wanted after she's forcefully has to leave the what had been his bedroom.
Yes, because of a blizzard.
Of a blizzard, yes, exactly, and a limb through the roof. I thought that was a great moment for her, you know, strength, and, you know, she's bargaining with him, and, you know, so I thought that was a great moment for her.
Yes, yes, she stands up for herself. There had to be moments like that through the book, you know, moments of reversal, you know, of real action, because there's not a lot of action in the book. It's, you know, people talking and mostly people talking at her. But, you know, she does move through the year and she moves through places. And so I needed a few turning points, like that conversation with the landlord, where unexpectedly she asserts herself and he listens.
Well, I'm going to walk up to almost giving too much away, I think, here. But she does use the word home in a phone conversation with her mother near the end.
Yes.
And that seemed to be relevant to what you're discussing.
Well, it's interesting. In an earlier draft of the book, I just had her, you know, talking to the airline representative. You know, she just tells the airline representative, I need to go home. Why can't you let me go home? And, you know, it didn't quite feel like enough. And then I was having a conversation with my agent a few months later. And, you know, that's about something unrelated. We were talking about kids. And she said, you know, I find, and her kids had grown up and they're living away from her. And she said, you know, I find that they call when they need something. So, you know, when I went back to revise the draft, I was like, huh, if there's ever a time in the novel when she needs something, it's at that end, it's at that ending, right? And that's when she calls her mother.
Did you use the H word, home, deliberately there and meaningfully?
Yes, yes. I mean, again, it's, you know, in that moment, Bangalore for her is home because that's where she's trying to get to. And, you know, and the fact that she's not able to get there, I think, makes it all the more home. And, you know, essentially, she can't stay in the U.S. because her visa has expired. There are not many places she can go. And so one place that won't turn her away is India because she holds an Indian passport. She's still an Indian citizen and her mother is there. So in that moment, that's where home is.
She does plan to come back.
Yes. Yes. So, of course, like 3 months later, she has a different living situation and feels good about herself in Boston, then Boston will be home. But it's situational.
Is it?
I think so. I think when you, and this is the other thing I was thinking of when I wrote that ending, and she's just had this conversation with Jenny, right, this English woman. You know, I wanted that to be like a really warm, sensitive conversation with a person who understands the world and understands history like in a profound way. And, you know, when Pavitra asks her at the end of their conversation, you know, where's home for you? And she says, home is just something I carry with me. Home is not, I don't think of home really as England. I don't think of India as home. Home is just something I carry with me. And in that moment, that's a comforting idea to Pavitra. She's like, oh yeah, home is something I carry with me like a turtle. But that's a very privileged idea because when we have to cross a border, it doesn't matter what ideas we have about where home is for ourselves. Borders are made without our permission, and we really don't have control over border crossing is where we essentially are at the mercy of the border guards. So when she's at that airport and she needs to cross a border to get to home and she's not being allowed to, then I think in that moment, the place that she's trying to get to is home. Like that's where safety is and she can't access it.
But in a sense, isn't part of her story in this year defining her own borders?
Of course. But again, I mean, to some degree, it's a fantasy, right? It's a necessary fantasy. It's how we have agency in life is telling ourselves that, you know, this is where we need to get to. This is what we have to do to get there and so on. But again, it's, you know, it's like free will. We're also at the mercy of forces larger than us.
Well, I wanted to come back to that thought, and we're getting there. I mean, she goes to an artist colony kind of late because I'd said earlier, you don't show us with her doing a lot of writing, but here she goes to this. I mean, but the scene, it's typical, I guess. You go to parties and you stand around or dinners or whatever, and you have conversations with other writers or sculptors or painters or whatever, and it just seemed like this was right there. That was that kind of moment where people are talking about, you know, art in some ways, but they're talking about their other things, you know, in other ways, totally non-art, just being people. And that, it seemed to me like herself was getting defined in that moment, both as an artist and as an individual. Am I making too much of it?
No. I think, that happens in a way in different parts of the book. But I agree that the artist colony is, the one place where she's not surrounded by students and colleagues and, you know, friends and so on. But it's the first time when she's there as an artist. Yes. And she does have this conversation with a Pakistani woman who is reading a little too much into her writing as a projection of herself, which is an assumption that, you know, people tend to make of writers. And it is that point in the novel where, you know, who she is has to come into clearer focus than earlier in the book, for sure.
Well, I was beginning to get that clearer focus, yeah.
I think of, you know, the conversations as sort of, you know, the walls or the faces of this prism that ultimately is all we get of Pavitra. We see her in these like different situations where every conversation kind of exposes a different cross-section of her personality, of her identity. And yes, it's not until the end that we see her as an artist, which is ultimately what she wants to be, yes.
Right. In the sense, I guess I took that first scene, which is one of the longer sort of opening scenes, but it sort of set the whole thing up for me and carried it all the way through. And my mind went back to it at the end, you know, because he talked about the iron filings in the beginning, the landlord does. And I see, in a sense, the narrative character kind of taking on the colorations, taking on the fleshing out, becoming, you know, something real. And when she's in that conversation as an artist, it seemed like that moment of fulfillment, in a sense.
Sure.
You know, whether you've got the publications or you've got the work done or not or whatever, I mean, there was varying levels of performance there around her, but they were accepting of her, it seemed.
Yes, yes. Well, also the rather caricature appears in that chapter with the poet, the vegan poet. He and the HR woman are both on the caricature end of the spectrum. But I don't think she could have had that. She could have reacted to that conversation in the same way in the beginning. I mean, because he's essentially like, you know, he's one of those people who really needs to know where she's from, right? And she plays with him, right? She teases him in ways that he doesn't get. And I think she's learned how to do that over the course of the year.
She's much more in control.
Yes.
And because of the narrative style that you use, she doesn't tell us that that's what she's doing. We get to see that and in a sense, sort of experience it, you know, almost directly and see a kind of triumph for her in that moment.
Yes, she doesn't have many triumphs, but that is one little moment. That's true.
Yeah. I mean, so it stands out because there aren't that many. It stands out and we go, wow, you know, yeah. That one, then when she says to the guy she's been dating, you know, don't come to India. We don't care. And then there was the guy that she dated in India who sent her an email afterward or something like that. Yes. And says, we can be friends, but that's it.
Yes, and he's not someone that it would be easy even to be friends with.
I didn't get that impression. I wouldn't want to be friends with him. No. They were, you know, kissing buddies, I gather, back home.
Yes, yes. No, there's a certain draw, which is why she goes to meet him when she's in India for that summer. That's the only scene that takes place, you know, outside the U.S. And I think in some way that just solidifies for her why she's chosen to be away from home. She needs some distance.
She doesn't do a lot of internalization. You don't show her without making a lot of judgments either. And with the vegan poet, it's kind of externalized in that sense, which is why I was getting at the issue of, you know, would this be her novel? If she was writing a novel about that year, would this be her novel? Because I was trying to see, you know, where her inner life was, you know?
Mm-hmm. No, she's, this is her life. It's not her novel. It's my novel, but her life.
But that's an important distinction, I think, you know?
Yes.
And I say that because there are some overlaps here. She's from the same hometown you are. You've been a teacher, you know.
It's all true, and at the same time, not a word of it is true.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Well, I just think that's important to establish, and, you know, for several reasons. There's also a moment in here where she's at a conference. I think it's in Seattle, and that was a kind of moment of getting a wisdom with these other, because it's a conference for teachers or educators who are not white, and it just seems like you had a good time bringing those characters together and letting them enjoy each other's company and share some inner lives.
Yeah. For the first time in the whole novel, she is, you know, surrounded by her counterparts at, you know, other schools. And she goes out to a dinner where three of them are from India in various ways, which is a rare, rare moment. And I had fun writing that conversation. It was challenging because it's much easier to write conversations when there's just two people, and then when there's a table, you work extra hard to make every character distinctive and have the whole thing be orchestrated in a way that, you know, can be understood, but that's also interesting and lively. And so the assumption that she would feel at the most, she would feel the most at home with these people that she presumably shares so much in common is constantly challenged, right? Because they make assumptions about her and she makes assumptions about them that are every bit as problematic as, you know, people who she would consider true strangers.
And you said that in the second one, we'll see her flowering on beyond this year. And it's a trilogy. So the third one will be her down the road of that?
Yeah. So the second one is called Conditional Permanent Residency. So it's another one of these liminal immigration statuses where if you get a green card through marriage to an American citizen, then for the first 2 years, you're a conditional permanent resident, and then you have to apply to have these conditions removed. So it's still an immigrant novel, but I think what I see is this more advanced stage of immigrant life where it's no longer about the shock of arrival. You know, that's optional practical training. I think conditional permanent residency is not unlike a marriage in the sense that it's the establishment of a long-term relationship where, you know, you negotiate boundaries, responsibilities. Instead of one voice, which is the case in optional practical training, now there's two voices that are essentially part of her subconscious. It's her and her husband. So it's just this next phase of being an immigrant. And then the third, which I haven't really started, is called Alien Naturalization. And I don't know yet what's going to happen in that book, but I think of that as this kind of third stage where all the rules that you follow as an immigrant to get to, you know, achieve stability, quote unquote, whatever that means, might have to be abandoned in search of something else more meaningful.
Well, at least it's, you're not bound by the Naturalization Act of 1790.
No, only by that of 1965, which hasn't been updated.
Which is its own problems, but at least it's, yeah. And do you have contracts for the second and third? Or is it, did you get a three-book deal, as I said?
No. I don't think I'd want to be under contract for something that I hadn't already written. But I have a really good relationship with my editor at Grey Wolf, so I'm hoping that she'll like the next one. But yeah, we'll see what happens.
Well, if she liked it half as much as I did, she'll love it and she'll take it and she'll, you know, tell them to pay you a big fat signing bonus or something in advance.
Well, we'll see. I'll keep you posted.
Well, please do. And I'll pass it along to the listeners. But for now, they should get optional practical training and they should read that and prepare for conditional permanent residency. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you. That was a lovely conversation.
Thank you for listening to Upstart Crow. If you enjoyed today's episode, please consider leaving a review on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you listen. Your feedback helps others find the show. You can also watch full episodes and clips from Upstart Crow on our YouTube channel. Be sure to follow us on social media and visit upstartcrow.org for more information about our episodes, guests, and ways you can support the podcast. You'll find all of those links in the show notes. Thanks again for listening, and we'll catch you next time right here on Upstart Crow, a part of Watershed Lit Radio.